This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Which of the following is true? People get fat because they're lazy and they pig out too much. People get diabetes because they eat the wrong foods. People get eye disease because, well, we don't know why. Actually, that third statement about eye disease is where we'd planned to start today, thanks to new science on a disorder called aniridia. But researchers investigating aniridia have now discovered fascinating genetic links to numerous other disorders. Disorders you'd never think to associate with a rare eye problem. If new theories pan out, mutating genes might have a lot to do with chemical imbalances behind a host of ailments, diabetes and obesity among them. Some of those connected to this groundbreaking research are with us this hour, so if cutting-edge science is your thing, please stay tuned. We'll be getting a whole lot more insight right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. In a few minutes, we're going to meet a remarkable woman who is probably the reason we're having the discussion that we are this hour. She is certainly the reason that far more scientists, researchers, and physicians are paying much more attention today than they were just a few years ago to a fairly uncommon eye disorder. And because of that increased attention, science is uncovering new clues not only about this particular kind of eye problem, but also about a host of other ailments, some of them quite common in today's world. But before we meet the woman who founded the Aniridia Foundation International, I'd like you to hear more about just what aniridia is and how research into that unusual disease could affect you. For that explanation, we turn first to two scientists. One is a physician and surgeon who both studies disease and treats patients with eye problems, ophthalmologist Peter Netland. Dr. Netland, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
And here in the Insight Studio, a biologist who specializes in the study of genetic connections to embryonic development, Robert Granger. Dr. Granger, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Well, Peter Netland, let's turn to you first. What is aniridia? Why should anybody care?
Well, Tom, that's one of the central questions here. It is a rare congenital disease that leads to an absence of the iris. Patients are born without the colored part of the eye. The part of the eye that makes the eye appear blue or brown is missing.
And the word aniridia itself means no iris?
Essentially means no iris. And so that's an uncommon problem, but the aniridia is due to a genetic problem that is now getting better understood, and Rob will fill us in more about that in a moment. But it leads to a number of different eye problems, some of which are blinding diseases, glaucoma and corneal disease, that we have to deal with on a daily basis. And it also has certain other associations with certain problems with the body, too. So these have led to some general significance for this study of this disease because it applies to problems that people have in the general population very commonly, glaucoma, corneal disease, and many metabolic problems and other issues like that. So maybe what I'll do is I'll turn it over to Rob to help understand a little bit about the underlying genetic problem because that's so important to understanding this disease.
Peter, it is. You know, the gene that's responsible, that's abnormal in this group of patients is PAX6, which is a gene that was first identified about 20 years ago. And it was a remarkable discovery because it was one of the first human genes to have been identified at all anywhere. And it was remarkable because of that very broad significance. And what we've learned since then is that one of the key genes, certainly one of the key genes for making an eye, not just in humans, but in mice, in frogs, and all the way down to the fruit fly. So it is a conserved gene that's essential for making an eye. And then in some way, it may make sense that when it's mutated, that it would have such a profound effect going well beyond the aniridia phenotype, as you mentioned.
PAX6. I want to get this pictured in my mind, Rob Granger.
Yes.
That's actually spelled PAX followed by the number 6.
That's right.
And that appears somewhere on everybody's DNA?
It does. Now, you know, human geneticists name genes in funny ways, so it unfortunately has no significance to the real PAX word that we think of. But every gene has a name, and every gene has a place in the genome. And there's a specific spot where PAX6 lies and gets, you know, mutated, as we say, in these human patients.
So what has been discovered in the past few years is something can go wrong with this particular gene, PAX6, in a way that ends up causing a human being to be born without an iris, the condition called aniridia. Am I tracking so far?
Absolutely. And this gene starts to work in the first 10 or 15 days of development, embryonic development. So it's having its main effect extremely early, and then all through life, in fact, it has recurring effects of different kinds.
So if you want to study aniridia, if you want to understand aniridia, if you want to see if there are ways of helping people who have aniridia, then it makes sense to know as much about PAX6, this gene, as possible. And as you and other researchers have been studying PAX6, you've discovered things that lots of people who've never heard of aniridia are probably going to want to hear about.
Well, I think that's right. And if I had one message, I mean, one of the messages I'd like to make today is the importance of using animal models to study diseases like this one. I think there's universal consensus that we simply can't study these problems in humans at those early stages. But in animals like mice or frogs or flies, one has the opportunity to do studies, particularly in an animal like a frog that I work on, where one can observe the early embryonic development and see exactly how the gene is working in a positive sense to make an eye, and how, if it were abnormal, it would perhaps destroy the function of the eye.
Okay, so a medical doctor and eye disease researcher, Peter Nedlin, a biologist and eye disease researcher, Rob Granger, either one of you, tell me more about why PAX6 is thought to be related to potentially a wide variety of disorders other than aniridia. I think included in the list at this point is glaucoma, diabetes, obesity, possibly reproductive problems.
Right, and that's the that's really the reason for such great relevance of this gene to us today. The patients who are born with this congenital anomaly, this loss or absence of an iris, also frequently later on in life develop other eye problems as well that are probably directly related to this in many ways. But they develop glaucoma, which can lead to blindness. They develop corneal problems. They may have retinal abnormalities. They may have crossing of the eyes. And they may have a variety of things, but particularly the most common things that we see are the glaucoma and the corneal disease. And these are found commonly in other patients too, and there are just very few genes that are known to actually cause these problems directly. So
if you're studying PAX6, you may get some understanding that helps with glaucoma for somebody who's never had anybody in their family who had aniridia.
Absolutely. And that's
so I guess people listening, Dr. Peter Nedlin, can probably understand that a gene associated with a rare eye problem might spill over into being associated with other eye problems. But how could it be associated with diabetes or obesity?
Well, that's something that has been an interesting pathway. You know, the gene is found in every cell in the body. It's present everywhere, and it has actions in different parts of the body as well. And they've not been well appreciated before, and we're beginning to see associations with other problems that we learn from, meeting with patients and talking with them, and also hearing their concerns, and also studying them as a population and as a group. And one of the interesting things that has come up has been the association with certain metabolic problems. And this, I think we can link back to a couple of studies, but essentially they showed an association of problems like obesity and other problems like that with this gene. And that's a really remarkable thing to think about, because there are not many genes that are known to that control body weight and factors like that. So this is an exciting kind of discovery to make. And I'd like to hear Rob's perspectives on that too, because it has so many metabolic implications that we're just now beginning to understand.
Biologist Rob Granger, do I understand correctly this gene that we're talking about, PAX6, associated with this rare eye disease, aniridia, that in studying it because of aniridia, you've determined that it may also, if there are malformations in this gene, it may cause problems in things like the pancreas?
Yes, absolutely. And while actually it was a study published by Peter Netland and colleagues in 2011 that noted the increased weight, for example, BMI, in some of his patients. But it wasn't, in some sense, a surprise to me, because we've known for a number of years from specific studies on animals and in humans that PAX6 is absolutely essential for the pancreas to function, and it's absolutely essential for certain gut cells that make hormones that may control appetite. That's the last point is still a bit conjectural, but that's exactly what we think could be happening in these patients.
Well, I want to ask you more about the specifics there, but I don't want to keep people listening waiting too much longer at the star member of our panel that I hinted at earlier. So joining us now is that remarkable woman I mentioned at the top of the hour. She was born with the eye problem we've been discussing, aniridia. And because in her case it was detected early, she was able to get treatment that has allowed her to do better with challenges associated with that disorder than might otherwise be expected. But a bit more than 10 years ago, frustrated with the lack of research into this disease, she founded a nonprofit organization to act both as a support center for others with aniridia, as well as to push for better science. To this day, she continues to serve as director of the Charlottesville-based Aniridia Foundation International. Jill Nerby, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you for having me here, Tom.
What do you most want people to know about aniridia?
I want people to know that aniridia is a challenging eye and medical condition that is passed into each successive generation. When a person with aniridia has a child, there's a 50% chance of having an aniridic child with every pregnancy. But despite that, because of people like Dr. Granger and Dr. Natland and our other medical and scientific board members making advances and getting more knowledge, there is a lot of hope to lead a very semi-whatever normal is life and to be very active and independent, and it's not a negative at all. You can be anything you want to be.
In the past 13 years, you've had 8 transplants and 29 surgeries just to keep the level of vision that you had 15 years ago.
Yes.
And many people who, although it's a fairly uncommon disorder, among those people who have it, this kind of story is not uncommon?
Correct.
In fact, many of those people lose their vision by the time they're your age.
That is true. Back many, many years ago, they did not realize that glaucoma was a part of aniridia. So many of these people my age never had their pressures checked, because it was thought to be an old person's disease, and so they never had glaucoma checked, and they ended up losing not only their vision, but their total eye as teenagers.
One of the things that you've done, and I know Peter is excited about this, and I know Rob is excited about this, and apparently there are other physicians and researchers who are as well. It's because of your work, a whole new kind of conference, of gathering of interested parties is happening every couple of years, where scientists and doctors are experiencing something that they probably never have before in a medical conference that's also pushing new research. We're going to talk about that when we continue here on Virginia Insight in just a bit more than 1 minute.
With us today on Virginia Insight, medical doctor and eye disease researcher Peter Netland, biologist and eye disease researcher Rob Granger, plus eye disease patient and founder of the Aniridia Foundation International, Jill Nerby. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham. So, coming up on Wednesday, July 31st, which means if you're listening to this show live on Monday, July 29th, it's going to be 2 days from now. From this Wednesday, July 31st, through Sunday, the 4th of August, another Aniridia conference is going to be held at the University of Virginia, where patients, doctors, and researchers will all gather. And if you want to know more about this particular conference, you can Google Aniridia Foundation. Aniridia is spelled A-N-I-R-I-D-I-A. You're nodding your head. I got it close to right? Okay. You can Google Aniridia Foundation. Or you can go to the Virginia Insight page at WMRA.org, and we've got links there for you.
You could also go to our website. It's www.make-a-miracle.org.
That's why I'm thinking that just Googling Aniridia Foundation is probably easier for people who don't have pencils at the moment. But for people who attend the first day, anybody who has low vision or vision impairment is invited to participate. And you have one of your free events is going to be the movie Going Blind.
Correct.
But I want to talk to you, Rob Granger, about this idea of these conferences that you now have every 2 years where doctors, researchers, scientists, and patients and their families all gather together. You experienced one of these for the first time a couple of years ago, and I understand it was transformational for you.
It was. I would have to tell you, Tom, that sometimes our academic meetings can be a little bit dry. And this meeting was just very, very different because there was, of course, great research at the meeting, and basic research and clinical discoveries that were described. But at the same time, the patients were in every event. Sometimes there were children with aniridia wandering through the hallways and even occasionally coming into the meeting room. I remember one or two of them while I was giving my talk. And it was not disruptive. It was inspirational to actually see the people that are afflicted by this disease when you're spending your career studying it, studying the gene responsible. So it's what inspired me to get involved with Jill and Peter in our sort of triad of patient care, clinical work, and research that we're trying to do now and continue in these meetings.
Okay, so to you listening, if you've been with us for at least a few minutes, you've heard us talk about this gene PAX6, about abnormalities in it being connected to the disorder aniridia, which means absence of an iris. But investigators looking at aniridia and this gene, finding out that it could be and is thought to be associated with a wide range of other human disorders, some of them quite common in our society. We have a medical doctor who does research into this. We have a PhD biologist who does research into this. We have a lifelong patient of the disorder who's one of the ones who's responsible that so much more research is going on today, all as our guests. So if you're hearing anything you want to ask them about or a comment or suggestion you want to offer, we do have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Or you can post to us on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Biologist Rob Granger, tell me more about how what we were talking about before the break, problems with the gene PAX6 are now thought to potentially be connected specifically to obesity. The common thought about obesity is we have a society that consumes too much sugar. What does a gene malformation have to do with obesity?
Well, you know, that's I might have an answer or two there, but it's also a huge question. The genetics of obesity and the propensity for obesity is not very well understood at all. Now, what happens in the aniridia patients is this tendency toward obesity, and we would hypothesize that this has something to do with either the pancreas problems or gut problems, intestinal problems in these patients, specifically potentially a compound that we make in our bodies. The technical name is GLP-1, a compound that is released when we eat. It signals the brain, at least this is how it's proposed, to say, I'm full. It's a satiation sort of hormone. And if you don't have enough of the gene that makes that hormone, the hypothesis would be you might be hungry all the time. And that's the kind of thing we're trying to investigate now in our animals and also during testing at this meeting to understand what in the patients may be wrong.
Peter Netland, anything to add?
Well, yes. It was actually the part of the evidence that pointed so strongly to a gene effect was the fact that this problem was found in the patients that had the gene aberration, not in normal siblings and others who were in the family. So,
and I'm sorry, we had a little dropout on the line there. So, could you repeat what you just said?
Yes. The gene it has this effect in patients who have aniridia, and who have the gene abnormality. But in normal siblings, normal brothers and sisters, and other family members, they don't seem to have the problem at all. So it's not an environmental thing. It appears to be something with the gene abnormality, which makes it very interesting to study this gene.
So GLP-1 is a kind of hormone, or you said compound, Rob?
Yes, it's a small protein that's secreted in your gut normally after you eat, and it does two things actually. It signals the brain and says I've had enough, and it also signals your pancreas to say get ready. You got to process all this food that I'm eating. So
if I eat a meal and my gut or whatever part of my body is supposed to be releasing this protein, it doesn't release properly, possibly because of a malformation in this gene PAX6 that you've been investigating. I'm going to stay hungry.
Exactly.
And there are other hormones that are also a thought to be associated with whether we get hungry or whether we feel satiated. And those may be connected to different genes as well?
Yes, there are several other compounds, some of which may be connected to PAX6 and others not. Another one that a colleague at the University of Virginia is studying is called ghrelin, which is also an appetite-related compound that could be affected by PAX6. So these are compounds we're looking at in samples from our patients at the meetings, again, to see if they're altered in a way that could account for their appetite problems.
That's Michael Thorner at the
University of Virginia, a very distinguished researcher there who did a lot of work identifying this compound.
I guess what I'm wondering for these different disorders, whether it's aniridia, which is what caused you to begin this research in the first place, or diabetes, or reproductive problems, or obesity, or we haven't even talked about yet. I understand there's also thought to be possibly some connection with this PAX6 gene mutation and autism. If somebody has a problem with this gene before they were born, and you identify that may be causing me to have excess hunger, or to have problems with how I process noise around me in my brain, or a propensity to diabetes. Can you do anything for me? Or once it's in the gene, is it just there and it's going to stay there for the rest of my life?
Tom, you've hit on an absolutely fundamental question, not just for this gene and this disease, but all of human genetics. And in some ways, we may be at a slight advantage here in trying to think of clever ways to solve both the eye problems and the gut problems. With regard to the eye problems, there are now research protocols for doing either gene therapy or stem cell transplants to correct genetic defects like this in children so that they may have a very brighter long-term prospect for vision. And in the gut cells, there may be ways of simply giving people a compound that could help to the symptoms that they have. Jill, do you have? I don't know if you want to add something here. Okay.
Just that it's very important. This is a big question, as you say, but it's very important for us, and why I started Anna Rudy Foundation, to unite these people so we can get data to people like you and our other researchers and doctors to answer these questions.
And Tom, I'd like to add a point too, that's a great point. And I'd like to say that, you know, in these conferences, as you mentioned earlier, we have all the different stakeholders, and among the patients and their families, we've learned a lot about how their attitudes can be very different. We have participants that are family members who have a child who may be a sporadic case of aniridia, and we have the patients themselves that have aniridia, and sometimes they have very different views of these problems. The parents may be striving towards everything to be normal, but the patients themselves are, as Jill mentioned, they're born with this gene the way that it is, and they don't fully have adapted, are working, and so forth. And many times they're perfectly satisfied with certain aspects of the disease the way it is. Now, I think none of them want to have glaucoma causing blindness or, you know, have anything that will impair their ability to function. But it's interesting to see, as part of this conference, it's been very enlightening to me to see how the perspectives can vary depending on how you look at these problems.
And these conferences have been going on for more than a decade now, every 2 years, where you have this unusual phenomenon of having patients as well as physicians and scientists and researchers all attending together.
Yes, and it's been inspirational to me as well. I think we've learned so much, and Jill hinted at this, but the patients themselves are motivated to help, and I admire them a lot. I think that they have the best of intentions to try to make the world a better place, really, and the families as well. So there's tremendously positive sentiments and feelings about that at the meeting, and there's a real team spirit, you might say, that develops among everybody that's there. But they really come from very different perspectives sometimes.
Biologist and embryonic development researcher Rob Granger serves as the W.L. Lyons Brown Professor of Biology at the University of Virginia. Medical Dr. Peter Netland is chair of the Department of Ophthalmology as well as the DuPont Gary Professor of Medicine at UVA. And Jill Nerby is founder and director of the Aniridia Foundation International. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you want to speak with any of our guests, we do have a phone line open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Dr. Netland, you met Jill Nerby how long ago?
Gosh, I think
1998.
Okay. So it's been a long time, and
you guys were in a different part of the world then.
Yes, we were both in a different part of the world, and I was actually coming from overseas as well, where I had spent a year as well. So, but I was inspired as well at the time, a similar experience as Rob described. It was an inspirational experience for me to meet Jill and to attend the early conferences and to join with her to try to help with the effort.
But you were her doctor when you were both living in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yes, so I have to say, I was as she was describing some of the challenges, and as you were describing some of the things that she went through, I was actually reflecting back on many of those experiences that we've shared together on the medical side as well. You know, and Jill's case is obviously every person is unique, but other patients have had difficulties, and having multiple surgeries and overcoming problems is just part of the basic attitude of this group. They're just really tremendous. There is another patient who is going for her doctorate in education and ended up having this process interrupted by multiple surgeries, at least five that I remember, and has kept working despite that and functioned beautifully through all these years. And I can describe children that I've known from birth that have overcome many problems and have gone on to achieve in school and become singers and other types of things too, that that really are really inspirational to see. So the patients in overcoming their problems are inspirational to me, and that's part of what keeps me going.
And I would like to just say that it's a reciprocal thing, because back in 2001, before AFI really got going, there wasn't a lot of research, a lot of information, and I think a lot of the patients felt a sense of hopelessness. And since AFI started and getting great
people... And the Iridia Foundation International, for somebody who's just tuned in?
Yes.
Okay.
And I think people like Dr. Lauderdale, Dr. Granger, Dr. Notland, and getting involved and taking a personal interest in us and our situation, especially at these conferences, has created more knowledge, more education, and more research than was going on many years ago. And I think that may be inspiring to them, but we get inspired from them being interested in us. And that's why this population wants to help and wants to give all their data so that we can continue to make a difference in everybody's lives.
Talking about aniridia, about research into a gene associated with that eye disorder called PAX6, and the research leading to discoveries that that gene's mutation could affect a number of other conditions, some of them much more common than the fairly rare condition aniridia. We have a doctor, a biologist, and a foundation starter here in our Insight studio. If you have questions or comments for them, you can reach us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or on Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. And on Facebook, we just got this in from Amanda, who asks, is PAX6 associated with additional eye conditions other than glaucoma and corneal diseases, such as, and I'm going to mispronounce this, I'm sure, I think it's called retinitis pigmentosa, or various types of macular degeneration?
Well, I can answer that.
Can you give us the correct pronunciation from what I hinted at?
Yes. You did very well, Tom. That was impressive. Retinitis pigmentosa and other types of macular degeneration. Well, it's not associated with the disease that we call retinitis pigmentosa, which is a pigmentary retinopathy that can lead to, you know, night blindness and eventually to loss of vision over time, usually later in adulthood. Or other forms of macular degeneration. The most common cause of blindness in the United States is age-related macular degeneration. So it doesn't really strongly associate with that, but it is interestingly associated with an absence of the central part of the retina called...
Peter, can you hold on for just a second? I'm so sorry, we're about to hit the break, but we're going to continue in just about 60 seconds. Jill Nerby was born with the congenital eye disorder that is the basis of much of our discussion this hour. In the early 2000s, in order to encourage more research and serve as a support center for people like herself, she founded the Aniridia Foundation International, which is now based in Charlottesville, Virginia. Rob Granger is a biologist who has spent much of the past 40 years studying genetic connections to the development of embryos. Just a few years ago, thanks in part to the Aniridia Foundation, he began research specifically into that unusual eye disorder and the PAX6 gene associated with it. Peter Netland is a physician and surgeon who both studies eye disease and treats patients with eye problems. He's also one of the founding board members of the Aniridia Foundation. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Phone number 888-WMRA-TALK. And Dr. Netlin, you were in the middle of telling us some more about a response to Amanda's question and one of the things she asked about macular degeneration.
Right. And Tom, thanks. That was a great question by Amanda, and it does relate to some very important eye diseases. And I was just pointing out that the PAC6 does not seem to be directly related to some of those conditions, but it is related in the sense that there is an absence of a portion of the central portion of the retina called the fovea, leading to foveal hypoplasia, we call it, or absence of the development of the fovea, which can lead to decreased vision at birth as well for these patients. So there is a retinal problem. It differs from the ones that were mentioned by Amanda, but it is a tie-in, at least, to retinal disease and one that we're very interested in.
So what you're saying, Peter, is that the gene, although it's named after its effect on the iris, really affects the whole eye. It affects the cornea, the retina, and leads to so many different problems. And from a developmental biology perspective, this makes perfect sense to me because we know the gene is active in every part of the eye, even from the young embryonic stages. And so it makes sense that there would be these broad effects.
Right. And a couple of the other areas that are affected in addition to the retina and also the glaucoma and cornea, the cataract is a very, very common problem in patients with aniridia. It's almost found in nearly all of the patients. And dry, something as common as dry eye is also found commonly in this group in the majority of patients with this problem. So again, at a very young age. So again, some very common problems that are found specifically in this disorder.
Rob Granger, PAX6 mutations in that gene now also thought to have some association with autism?
Yes. Tom, the gene is not only active in the eye, and we've discussed the pancreas and the intestine, but during embryonic development, one can see that it's active in the regions of the brain that surround the eye. In fact, most people don't know this, but the eye is actually integrated into the brain in a young embryo and just grows out from it. But it's really part of your brain. And so the gene is active in a number of different parts of the brain and has important functions there. And I think what you're alluding to is the fact that and Jill, you can comment about this in a minute. What we see in young patients, particularly kids, is that they often have challenges in school because they can't concentrate very well. And scientifically, we're beginning to understand that's because they can't integrate the information that they're hearing. They can hear fine, but that they can't integrate the information very well.
Have I heard you say in the past, Rob, that what they tend to hear just sounds like being surrounded by noise?
That's right. And that's because the brain function of PAC6 is to help integrate that information. It's not exactly autism, but it's a lot like it. And Jill, maybe you want to comment about what you hear from the parents and the kids in school.
We do hear from parents that they do have issues in school, much like you just said. But there have been many people that have been reported that their child has been diagnosed with Asperger's, which is currently one of the forms of the autism spectrum disorders.
Right. And it's not clear that it's exactly the same thing. These things are hard to characterize, but the end result is the same for the child, that they have the challenges in school. And one of the things that I find also so interesting about these meetings is that there are sessions that are devoted to where you have educational specialists that talk about that aspect of the how to help the kids, so you have the whole sort of whole view of how to take care of them.
Yes, and the sometimes the learning or hearing issues are compounded by some of the other disabilities. If a child is born with decreased vision, the decreased vision can affect how they hit their developmental milestones as well. They may be more tentative to walk and hit other milestones, and so this can be another factor that can be compounded and additive as the children enter school age and then try to get through school.
Aniridia, this disorder that basically is the absence of an iris that is thought to be genetic. Do I understand correctly, Jill Nirby, that there are actually two kinds? There's the kind that's inherited, and then there's the kind that you have that is sometimes called sporadic. In other words, nobody in your family had it, and nobody knows quite how you ended up with it.
Correct. Sporadic typically means neither one of your parents have aniridia. DNA can be mutated by any number of things, chemicals, environment, whatever. But once a child with aniridia, sporadic aniridia, is born, they start an inheritance line where every pregnancy that they are involved in carries a 50% chance of having a child with aniridia. I was born sporadic. Neither one of my parents had it, but I had a son.
Nor your brother or sister.
My brother or sister.
And do I understand correctly that it wasn't until after you already knew that you were pregnant with your son, who's now in his 20s, but it wasn't until you were pregnant that you learned that this disorder had a genetic likelihood of being passed on?
That's correct.
How did you, after all the years of struggle, I don't know how old you were when you were pregnant, but it'd probably been a couple of decades of struggling with this disease for yourself when you learned while you were pregnant for the first time that your child might have it. How did you respond? What did you think? What did you feel?
Well, my experience is a little bit different. I was considered basically a higher functioning aniridic because my vision was good enough, like 20/40, 20/50, to drive when I was a teenager, whereas my son, who inherited it, and this just shows the variation not only from family to family, but within the family, he has never been able to drive because his vision is more like 2100 to 2200 with correction. So back then, I was 28 when I got pregnant. I didn't know it was genetic, because a lot wasn't known. You'd go look up aniridia back then, and it would said lack of iris. Said nothing about being genetic, really. And so I was only told when I got pregnant that I needed to see a genetic counselor.
How did you come to form this push to say to doctors and scientists around the country and around the world, find out more about this disease?
Well, basically, I started dealing with the corneal scarring that we've been talking about. And
that comes as someone with aniridia gets older?
Yeah. Well, some children actually have it, but that's rarer. But yes, the corneal scarring was very devastating to me. It was a big loss of vision. And I tried to do some investigating. I had my education, interested in the medical area. So I did a lot of Googling and kept coming up with lack of iris. And I kept saying, that's not the only thing, and that's not the thing that causes the loss of vision. So why isn't there more going on about it? And I asked a researcher, why isn't more being done? And he basically said, we don't see a lot of people with this, so we can't do a reliable research on it. So that's why I got the idea to unite these people with aniridia and collect the data so that we would have a data bank to give to researchers like Rob and Jim Lauderdale and Dr. Netland.
Who came up with the idea of holding a conference where patients were involved and not just the doctors and researchers?
I'm guilty of that. I just figured that, first of all, I thought, okay, the researchers and doctors don't talk to each other because they go to their own conferences. But what we do need is we need to have them feed off each other. And so the researchers need to talk to the doctors. And then I said, I've been talking with all these aniridia patients and coming up, and I'd go to the researcher and I said, you know, Dr. Lauderdale, you know, I see a lot of people with aniridia having the same problem. And Dr. Netland, maybe you can relay when we were in Chicago and you walked around asking people and came to me and said there were a lot of people that had retinal detachments and that wasn't even in the literature. So just feeding off all three of us, the patients, the doctors, the researchers, we're all working together as a team to basically make a miracle.
So let me amplify on this. If you have one patient that comes in and has, we've talked about this, a sleep problem, you don't know if it's a something unusual to that person. But when you get 20 or 30 or 40 together and you do a study on all of them, then you have a way of really trying to understand if it's a general problem and then really do something about it. That's a power of these meetings and a power of this sort of thing that you started, Jill, I think.
Rob Granger, a biologist, you've been doing research since the 1970s. Your specialty has been embryonic development. You got in on it sort of the early years of investigating DNA. I'm sure you've gone to lots of conferences and talked to lots of researchers around the world, and yet you tell us it was 2 years ago, the very first time, because of the work that Jill started, that you attended a conference where there were researchers, where there were physicians who treat patients, and there were patients all together, and you found it inspirational, and it helped spur you on to some of the new discoveries that you're making. So I'm wondering if there might be somebody listening who say, well, look, there's nobody in my family who has eye problems, but cancer's in my family,
exactly.
Or heart disease in my family, or diabetes is in my family. Why are researchers in those fields not doing what you guys are?
Well, it takes the leadership of the right people to bring this all together, I would say, on the one hand. On the other, very, very wonderful patient support groups for each of the diseases that you've mentioned and that are vital to the research and clinical functions at major universities like the University of Virginia. What I think is unusual for us is that we've brought them all together physically in one place at one time, not that the different groups don't exist. And it's not easy to do that. Planning these meetings is a nightmare because of the many dimensions that one has. So I think Jill deserves the extra credit here for starting the idea. But I wish and I hope that it will be an expanded theme in a lot of human genetic diseases, including the ones you mentioned.
Peter Netland, I feel like Rob is sort of bowing out of any tough answer to my question there. But in addition to your MD, Peter, you also have a PhD. You've done lots of work as a researcher and as a physician. You've worked in different places of the world, including the Middle East. What do you think about the importance of the kind of conference that's now held every 2 years for all stakeholders in this rare disease, aniridia, and whether or not we might move science and medicine forward if we had something going on similar for other disorders and diseases?
Well, yes, Tom, it's a very catalytic or synergistic combination, and I think it has led to some true advances in how we manage many aspects of this disease. It's also allowed individuals in areas to see other parts of the life of patients that they may not realize is affected in the way that it is. So it's been enlightening and inspirational and synergistic and all of those good things that we'd like to see more often. Now, I'd have to say, echo what Rob said, that the normal conference for physicians or for researchers is not set up this way. And perhaps we will see a trend towards this in the future. I personally think it's been helpful and unique and a very positive thing. And I can give examples of some of the positive effects that we've seen and some of the tangible results that we've seen. But anyway, I hope it is a trend, and I hope that we do see more of it. I believe that it's a very effective combination and very useful way to go for all of us.
Jill Nerby, I'm not going to give you away your age. Actually, I don't literally know, but it is my understanding, as someone born with aniridia, absence of an iris, you have struggled with this disorder for in the neighborhood of 5 decades.
Yes.
What's on your wish list?
My wish list is that we can advance research, create better treatments so that the children that are born today and in the future will not have to go through this life, going through the ups and downs of medical issues and emotional issues related to having so many challenges. And I think that by advancing research and creating better treatments, these children will have a very different life than people that are older like myself have.
Our guests have been Jill Nurby, founder and director of the Aniridia Foundation International. Let me say that correctly. The Aniridia Foundation International. Plus Robert Granger, embryonic development researcher and professor of biology at the University of Virginia. And by phone, Peter Netland, physician, professor of medicine, and chair of the Department of Ophthalmology at UVA. Thank you also very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you for having us.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers are Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. We had extra help today from Susan Comfort. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you'll find links to more information about all of our guests and the work they are doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.